Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Justice. Now, the Wave's ongoing pursuit to bring our communities closer.
Welcome to Justice Now. I'm Pat Prescott. Criminal justice is at the heart of this discussion about systemic racism. And now with the historic selection of Kamala Harris, California's former state attorney general, as a presumptive Democratic vice presidential candidate, the spotlight on the American criminal justice system is sure to play a heightened role during the remainder of the presidential campaign season. The American police model, which was largely born of the need to control enslaved Africans, has led us today to a national prison complex that is seen by many as modern-day slavery. African Americans and Latinos make up 28% of the U.S. population, but 56% of the prison population. African Americans are incarcerated in state prisons across the country at more than five times the rate of whites and at least 10 times the rate of whites in five U.S. states. The numbers don't add up unless you look closely and see how access to justice is clearly not equal for all. Just watch Ava DuVernay's acclaimed film 13th or Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan's Just Mercy. There are thousands of stories like these. Tonight, we'll take a closer look at a local political and ideological battle that could bring major changes to the criminal justice system in Los Angeles. The two candidates have more than 60 years of experience in law enforcement between them and sharp differences in their platforms as we move closer to a runoff battle for the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. Our guests tonight are L.A. County Supervisor Hilda Solis, representing the 1st District, L.A. County incumbent Jackie Lacey, and challenger George Gascon. Let's take a look at the challenger.
It wasn't the first time it happened, but I'll never forget that night. I was 17, on a date with my girlfriend in LA. The police pulled me over for no reason. As I sat on the curb, they took out the seats and tossed everything onto the sidewalk. When they didn't find anything, we were left there to put my car back together. I was nobody to them. In that moment, I had every right to be angry. But that's not who I am. That's not what I was taught. I grew up in communist Cuba, and my dad taught me that giving up was never an option. We can be smart and tough in how we fight crime, but only if we work to be a partner with the community, to see the humanity of all people, to serve with honor. But it's up to us to speak up, to reject failed policies, to reject a system that punishes the poor and protects the powerful. Los Angeles is ready for change. That's why I'm running for district attorney. Because when you face a problem, you can stay on the curb or you can put the car back together again. And I know together, we can get Los Angeles moving forward.
George Gascon was born in Havana, Cuba, and his family migrated to California when he was 13. He's an Army veteran who served honorably in the 64th Military Police Detachment and then went on to graduate from Cal State Long Beach. He has dedicated his life to law enforcement, working his way up in the LAPD from a patrol officer to assistant chief of police under Chief William Bratton. He went on to become chief of police in Mesa, Arizona, and then San Francisco. Gascon replaced Kamala Harris as San Francisco district attorney when she won her Senate seat. In November, he hopes to become the next DA of Los Angeles County, and he joins us tonight to talk about it. Please welcome George Gascon. All right, we got a great panel joining us today. Frankie Ross, who is the host of the evening show on The Wave, and our assistant brand manager, Frankie, joins us. Hi, Frankie.
Hey. Hi, Pat.
We've also got our colleague, Ken Charles, who is a program director of KNX Radio. And we welcome Ken.
Thanks for having me be a part of this.
We're happy to have you here. Well, Mr. Gascon, let's get started. You are known for supporting police reform, and recently we've been hearing a lot about defunding the police. Can you explain what that means to you and exactly what your position is on that?
Sure. What it means to me is something that I've been saying for a long time, that we need to continue to reduce the footprint of the criminal justice system, and we need to shift the money into public health, education, mental health services, and other services that, quite frankly, will provide a much better outcome for our community. So when I co-authored Prop 47 back in 2014, one of the goals was to take money away from the Department of Correction. That actually became $500 million a year that came out of prison system, and it came to local communities for mental health services and education. That journey needs to continue. One of the things that I hope to do if I get elected is, as we reduce the level of incarceration in the county, as we did in San Francisco, where we had about a third of our daily population vacancy, is take the money from the jail system and take the money from the work that leads to the jail system and start shifting the money into community-based services, public health, education. And I think it's a continuous process. I don't believe that we can do it all at once, but certainly we have to be intentional. I would tell you that a very good friend of mine, Holly Mitchell, says that budgets are a statement of beliefs, are a statement of your philosophy, are a statement of values. And I very much agree with that. And I think that as we do, each of us do our part. I will do my part by shrinking the work that the prosecutors do. We need the board of supervisors and we need other players in the system to start shifting that money into other verticals that are going to provide much better services for our community.
But who are those people? You know, you talk about shifting the money, but who's actually going to get the money? What kind of training are they going to need? You can't just do that overnight, can you, George?
No, you cannot do it overnight. We know that we have a public health department. We know that we have many nonprofits that are already trained that are doing the work. You're talking about gang interventionists. We're talking about people that have mental health training. We're talking about people that have, quite frankly, that work in our educational systems, right? There are a lot of professionals that are there that are terribly underfunded. And what we need to do is we need to start shifting that money into those places and continue to evolve so that when there is a call for a mental health problem and the corner walk and don't walk, right? When George is in the corner talking to himself and you call 911, rather than that 911 response be a badge and a gun, it should be a mental health clinician. Now, we may not have that today, but there is no reason why we should not have it in the next 2 or 3 years. So if we start shifting the funding and we start moving funding into the current systems that are in place, the nonprofits that are working in the place, mental health and education, and we continue to build the capacity to start also having those responses.
Well, the problem, though, as you know, is that they're underfunded, and I think everybody would agree with that. Also, those people are overworked. So just giving them money is not going to solve the problem, correct?
No, of course not. The money has to come in with a commitment to hiring enough staff to get the work done.
But you've had some success over the last couple of years with violent crimes and incarceration doing some of that, right?
What we did in San Francisco is we reduced our incarceration rate, and we put more emphasis on working with community-based organizations, as well as focusing very clearly, rather than dragnet, focusing on those people that are most accountable for violence. What we saw is we continue to see a very interesting phenomenon where our incarceration rate went down and our reduction in violent crime continued to stay steady. By comparison, LA County incarcerates at about four times, we're talking about prison commitments, about four times the rate in San Francisco, but LA County has seen approximately a 29-30% increase countywide in violent crime during the same period of time, which we're talking about the tenure of the current DA. Our jail in LA and San Francisco was generally about 30 to 35% vacancy daily rate. And that came from a jail that was full to capacity and sometimes in excess capacity in 2011 when I became the district attorney. Again, we see here LA County, a jail that is always full and, you know, way beyond capacity often. So the point that I'm trying to make as I talk around with our community is that high levels of incarceration do not necessarily translate in more community safety. In fact, it could have an inverse impact, because what happens, especially when you incarcerate young people or you incarcerate people with mental health problems, what you do is you create a vicious circle where recidivism increases as you take people that have very little criminogenic factors, but as they get thrown into the jail setting or the juvenile custody setting, they actually begin to have more problems. They get more traumatized.
And so you're not talking about violent criminals. You're talking about drug crimes and things like that, correct?
Actually, listen, you have to put it all on the table, because sometimes even some perceived to be violent crimes, sometimes the best interventions are not going to be always incarceration. You have sometimes people that are traumatized, that they need mental health services, they need some other types of intervention that a jail is not necessarily going to fix that. And we have to remember, 95% of the people that we send to custody, whether jail or prison, are coming back out, right? So the question is, we have a system now that fails about 70% of the time or more, meaning people that go in, come back, and they reoffend over and over again. And we know, and we actually were able to show in San Francisco, by using restorative justice model with kids under 18 or the 18 to 25, where we started the first in the country young adult court, is that actually we can take serious crimes and we can drive different levels of intervention with mental health services, substance consumption problems, housing, employment, all these other things that sometimes will stop the circle of violence. So it's not just simply saying, we're not going to look at violent crime ever. Obviously, if someone's continuing to be dangerous to the community, that's a different conversation, right? You may have to have some level of incapacitation if somebody's going to go out and hurt other people, but that's not always the case. There are sometimes cases that may involve some level of violence that are kind of a one-off, where they're driven by a whole bunch of factors and it's not necessarily going to be a serial offender. So having the capacity for the system to be nuanced in the approach to the work is really important. We're not making cars, we're not making widgets, we're dealing with human beings. Each of us is a different individual, and we may be at different places at different times, and trying to customize the way that we do our work and look for the lowest level of intervention possible in order to achieve the community safety goal.
You know, since the murder of George Floyd, there's been a lot of scrutiny put on district attorney's offices across the country. People are really concerned about the fact that we're watching people being killed before our very eyes, and nothing ever happens about it. What can be done to make sure that people who have killed people and are guilty of that can be convicted?
Well, look, I think that there is multiple things that we need to do. I mean, number one, we need to rethink the way that police force is treated by the law. And we started in a journey in that direction. Actually, Assembly Member Shirley Weber from San Diego started more than 2 years ago. I was the only DA that supported her in trying to bring legislation that would lower the threshold when a police officer on duty commits a violent crime, lowers the threshold of accountability. And the level of accountability under the first bill was the force had to be minimum and necessary, and the officer had to look for other alternatives. That unfortunately failed because police unions went after, and it was somewhat gutted, but we nevertheless wound up with a new law that says it has to be necessary. I think that's the beginning of a journey in one place. On the other part, even under existing prior laws, we've had cases where clearly the force wasn't reasonable. We've had cases where the chief of police has asked the current DA for a prosecution. We saw that with a young man in the Venice Beach area that was unarmed, and he was shot and killed. And the current DA refused to move forward with that case. And by the way, that's a very unusual case in that very seldom would a chief of police come to a district attorney on an use of force case and ask the DA to prosecute the case. So we have to do a couple of things. We need to address some of the old cases And one of the plans that I have, I'm working with a group of civil rights lawyers to review all their cases that would have to be viewed through the lens of the old law, but see if there are cases there where criminality is present and the case is prosecutable, and then I will appoint a special prosecutor to handle those cases. Moving forward is applying the new law and see where that takes us. At the same time, one of the things that I want to do and will do if I get elected is lobby in Sacramento to try to create a separate office, provide the vehicle for counties to county voters or the county board of supervisors to create a separate office to investigate police criminal conduct on duty. So a killing by a police officer will be investigated by this group. If it happens to be unlawful or determined to be unlawful by the group, then they would handle the prosecution. By creating that separation, we eliminate the public trust issue when it comes to district attorneys.
Knowing what you just said about special prosecutors, would you have then handled the Mario Woods case differently from back in 2015?
Well, not with the law that we had there. Actually, in Mario Woods, we actually did several things. I sent it to the Justice Department under Eric Holder to take a look. I sent it to Kamala Harris's Justice Department. I also work with the one dean of a law school and another professor to take a view. Not only did we look at it, and by the way, by this time I had a team that were former civil rights lawyers. We looked at it under the current law at the time. There was not much that we can do, even though I went publicly. And when I said that we would not be able to prosecute the case, the first thing that I said is this is an unnecessary shooting. Now, what was the problem with Mario Woods? Mario Woods had a knife. Mario Woods has stabbed somebody. As the victim of the stabbing was being taken to the hospital, the call came up about a man with a knife. The officers confronted Mr. Woods, and they walked with him for a period of time. And we know this, by the way, because there's a lot of cameras for this, right? You can see that Mario Woods is struggling as he's walking. He gets down, he's up against the wall. There's basically a circle of officers around him, and he's still holding the knife, and he's being told to drop the knife, which he's not, but you can tell that he's very, he's really struggling. And then you have Officer Woods, who steps in front of Mario, Officer August steps in front of Mario Woods. He is now about somewhere between 8 feet apart. And allegedly, according to the officer, Mario Woods is lunging at him. Now, if you look at the video, I think that most of us would say Mario Woods is not lunging. Mario Woods is almost tripping. And the question was, why did Officer August have to step in front of him at that time? Why could they not continue to walk? Now, what Officer August said in his testimony during the investigation is that he was fearful for the life of the people who were on the bus stop right behind him. And he felt that he needed to stop Mario Woods from going any further because Mario had already stabbed someone. The other officers, on their part, said they were afraid for the safety of Officer August. So basically, each officer individually made a decision when they all decided to fire. Unfortunately, under the old law, not only did I determine that it was not a prosecutable case, but we had a lot of people look at it, and everybody came to the same conclusion. Now, under the current law, the question would become, was the shooting necessary? I would argue that it wasn't, but that was not the law operating at the moment.
Now, that's the same, you know, justification that Jackie Lacey has used for the 600-some-odd shootings that have occurred under her watch, that under the law, they're not prosecutable. How do you respond to that?
Well, the difference is Jackie Lacey has a lot of cases where you have unarmed men. So, like in the case in Venice Beach, for instance.
That's Brendan Glenn, by the way. That case is Brendan Glenn.
Yes, Brendan Glenn. Yeah, I was trying to avoid using his name. But yeah, Brendan Glenn, he was unarmed, right? There was no evidence that he was assaulting anyone. And in fact, the chief of police says, this is a case that should be prosecuted. The problem with the current DA in LA County is that we're not talking about armed people, which may or may not be necessary, but they were okay under the law. We have cases where clearly you have unarmed individuals and they're being killed, and there's little evidence that there was any weapons involved.
If you were the DA in that case, would you have prosecuted?
I would say so, and that's one of the cases that we would definitely take a second look.
I wanted to ask, there was an op-ed piece wrote about a year ago in the Antelope Valley Times. It was It was titled "George Gascon Wreaked Havoc in the San Francisco's DA's office," and it said that it was becoming increasingly hard and difficult to prosecute under your leadership. It said 61 attorneys left out of 140, 24 in the last 8 months of 2019 alone. But what happened?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of pieces. So that particular piece was written as a result of some disgruntled employees. I had to deal with some discipline issues with people that were not, that were not following the policies of the office. But what is also very disingenuous about that particular article is they don't tell you that actually roughly most of those 20 people that left in the last few months is when I announced that I was leaving. That's when that group started to leave. When I came into the office in 2011, we began, and I say we because it was a team. You know, we had many other good people in the group, decided that we were going to start moving away from hiring the traditional mindset, the people that come into prosecuting offices. In doing so, we started shifting the culture of the office, which obviously created tensions with some of the more traditional prosecutors that have been there for years, including, you know, some of the people that participated in penning that op-ed piece, and people that were coming in that were coming with a very different approach to the work. As we continued to evolve in our office, we became a place that was often looked upon as a model of progressive prosecution. Not only did we have crime going down, but we were lowering incarceration. We were diverting a lot of cases. That makes some people very unhappy. You know, if you're a lock 'em up kind of prosecutor, that's not the approach that you're going to like.
Well, listen, we have heard a lot, and we want to thank you for spending some time with us today. We wish you the best of luck moving forward. And thank you so much for everything you've done so far for our city.
Well, thank you so much, and look forward to continuing our conversation in the future.
And now let's take a look at the incumbent.
The first female and the first African-American to lead the DA's office.
L.A. County District Attorney Jackie Lacey.
Jackie Lacey.
District Attorney Jackie Lacey.
The first in the nation mental health division.
A first of its kind for a prosecutor's office in California.
That's Jackie Lacey, L.A. County's District Attorney.
Jackie Lacey was born in Los Angeles and grew up in the Crenshaw District, where she attended Dorsey High School. She graduated from UC Irvine and then went on to pursue her law degree at USC Law School. Lacey joined the LADA's office in 1986 as a deputy district attorney, where she continued to move up the ranks, taking on management and executive roles in the office. In 2011, she was named chief deputy DA, and later that year, she announced her candidacy for district attorney. In December of 2012, Jackie Lacey made history, becoming the first woman and the first African American to serve as district attorney of Los Angeles County. She's a two-term incumbent who hopes to serve another term following the upcoming November election. Tonight on Justice Now, we welcome Jackie Lacey.
Jackie, you're the first African-American to hold your office. You're the first woman to hold your office. So you're the 42nd person. That's a remarkable accomplishment. But it's rather interesting that despite that, Black Lives Matter wants you out of office. How do you deal with that?
First of all, it seems very surreal, right? We all celebrate first, because when you get a first, you realize the doors are open, that hopefully there'll be others. For instance, I remember celebrating President Obama when he got elected, right? That was huge. But with being a first comes a lot of responsibility. And I'm Black, I'm from the community, I'm from the Crenshaw District, and people expect a lot from you, and I accept that. With regard, though, to the matter at hand, it is an out-of-body experience to know that Black Lives Matters has indicated they want me out. I really, in my heart of heart, feel that there's a lot of commonality amongst us. I believe in equality. I believe in, I want less people to die at the hands of police. And I know what racism feels like, personally. But I feel like what's going on now is there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of numbers out there that aren't factually based, and people aren't making decisions necessarily based on the facts. And as a prosecutor, I'm a fact-driven individual. And what I hope one day is that we will be able to sit down and talk and work together toward a more perfect justice.
Black Lives Matter, why won't you meet with them, or have you?
I've tried, Frankie. I've actually met with Black Lives Matter's LA leader, Malina Abdullah, twice since I've been DA. I've met with smaller groups. I've met in a large group, large town hall. I have offered to meet with her again, but it's got to be a dialogue. You know, it's got to be, what I've said is, can you just bring 20 people and let's really sit down and work towards solutions? And Frankie, it hasn't been that way. It's been more of, you come out with a group of 50 people and we're going to scream and yell at you and take out our frustrations and anger. I can take that if, in the end, we can sit down and work towards some solutions. Do we need more training? Do we need more mental health care? What do we need to accomplish that? And that's been the issue. It's not that I won't meet. I tried. But I want it to be something where we actually sit down and work toward solutions. Work toward and respect each other's right to have differing opinions, and that's really been an unnecessary stalemate in this conversation and in this relationship.
Ms. Lacey, the name of this episode is Politics to Policy. What would you say to someone watching right now or listening in their car? They said, you know what? I went to a march. I went to two marches. I signed petitions. I got involved. I thought we're going to get police reform. And then now I hear on the news, police reform is languishing in Congress. What would you say to that person?
I would say my father was, he was somebody who wrote books all the time. There's a book I just finished trying to reread again because it's so complicated. It's called Community to Chaos, and it was written by MLK, Dr. Martin Luther King. Change takes time. It takes hard work. You can show up for a protest, and that's an hour and a half commitment. But real change takes a long time. It takes education. It takes changes in the legislature. It takes people running for office, the right people running for office. And what I would say is this issue of racism has been in America for a long time. This issue of the relationship between police and black and brown people has been here for a long time. And just showing up at a protest isn't going to do it. We need people to do the hard work. And that's what Dr. King talked about, is a lot of people will show up for that protest, wear that t-shirt. They may even give money, but will they really do the hard work? And I'm a hard worker. My attitude is I form committees, I get alliances together, I change laws. I may not stand there and get a lot of fanfare because that's just not what I'm about. But changes are happening behind the scenes, and people need to dig deep and educate themselves. And I'm shocked. I'm shocked at the number of people who are just uninformed and will go into ballot boxes and vote based on emotion and not really based on a real thorough investigation of the facts.
God, we could do an entire show just on that. You brought up numbers earlier, and one of the numbers that the people from Black Lives Matter bring out is 601, that there are 601 shootings of people of color by officers in LA, none of which have been prosecuted by your office. How do you respond to that? And in fact, we've spoken to George Gascon, and he brought up the Brandon Glenn shooting and said if he were in your shoes, he'd have prosecuted that.
All right, a couple things. One is that the 601 is a false number. There have not been 601 people who have been shot by the police since I've been DA 2012. That number is fake. The real number, because I've counted, is like 325 cases. 325 cases.
It's a lot.
Which is a lot. Of course it is. But here's what I want people to understand. George Gascon can throw up Brandon Glenn. What about Mario Woods? Mario Woods was a case where Colin Kaepernick took a knee He didn't file that case. He was the DA in San Francisco. And his explanation was the law. Same thing with Michael Brown in Ferguson. Just 2 weeks ago, the new DA who got in reviewed it, and this is the third review. And he found there wasn't enough evidence to file a criminal case. He said, in very eloquent terms, look, I as a DA don't like what the police officer did. I think he could have done some things, but the law says that you have to prove that a crime occurred, that a homicide occurred. So here's my message to your viewers, because this is my station. I listen to you guys, okay? Why are the standards different for me, the first African-American woman in this position? If the same law prevented Mr. Gascon in San Francisco from filing the case, that prevented Ken Bell in St. Louis from filing the case, it prevents prosecutors all over the country from filing the case, why is my standard different? Here's the deal. We are the only office besides San Diego who is currently prosecuting an officer for shooting. We're prosecuting a sheriff's deputy right now. In terms of excessive force, I've prosecuted over 25 officers for excessive force. We filed 200 cases against officers for on-duty and off-duty conduct. I want you, when you're making a decision about who to vote for DA, don't just go with a politician who's promising you rhetoric, what I will do. Look at their record. Look at their record. And in San Francisco, Mr. Gascon's record was not one who went after police officers. It wasn't. He's coming down here, jumping in front of the protesters and saying, vote for me, I'll set you free. Remember that song, vote for me, I'll set you free? And that's what he's doing, and it's false. And we're starting to expose him as a hypocrite. We've got some videos out called Just Ask George, and it's about the moral issue. It's about the fact that you talk about Black Lives Matter targeting me. So what's the alternative? A guy who was an LAPD former commander for 30 years, who was on the Board of Rights, who let every officer off lightly on punishment, who as DA didn't file on any shootings? That's what I want to say to the protesters. Wake up. Think about what you're doing and what you're saying. Don't just follow what people are telling you, but look at the evidence. Look, I'm the first to admit we need changes in the criminal justice system. It is painful to see the number of African-American men in prison, in jail, on probation. How do you think I felt being in a courtroom? That's another difference between my opponent. He's never really been in a courtroom ever. I worked my way up from sweeping the floors, you know, literally in terms of low-level cases, to being the top prosecutor. I've tried over 100 cases, everything from child molestation to homicide to rape. And it was always very difficult being an African-American in that courtroom and looking around and noticing that only you and the defendant are people of color. Always difficult. But what you want in a prosecutor is, you know, some people, they do things, there needs to be accountability because we need safe communities. But you want somebody who's compassionate with a heart, who looks for creative ways. And once people have done their time, they ought to come out. They ought to have their voting rights restored. They ought to be able to get a job. They ought to have a job waiting for them. And they ought to be able to be received back in society. And when you look at some of the things that I've done with mental health, even working on getting treatment, how we really, this is a big civil rights issue of our time. We could get people with mental health issues into treatment ahead of time. You wouldn't even have to call the police. The police should not be responding to those calls unless there's a danger. And I've led a group, I published something called the Blueprint for Change. And we're following that blueprint. We've trained over 2,000 officers on how to de-escalate a situation with someone with mental health. Our reports created a department that has $150 million to house people, to give people help. You know, when parents are struggling with someone who's mentally ill, who has a mental illness, they call our office for help because we have the only mental health division probably in the country. And we're working behind the scenes to really make sure that people get help and can get justice.
How do we pay for some of the change you want to see?
You have to redirect resources. We shift priorities. There does need to be more social services. And in LA County over the last 5 years, we've actually done that. There hasn't been a lot of fanfare behind it. But somehow the board of supervisors, after I advocated for it, set aside $150 million for that. There's something called a millionaire's tax that funds the Mental Health Services Act, which is a statewide fund that comes to counties who are dealing with people who have a mental health thing. The county was a little dysfunctional. You may not know that. They gave some of that money back for years because they couldn't spend it. That's a crime, as far as I'm concerned, because we need it here in LA County. 30% of the people that I see have untreated mental health issues. A whole bunch of people I see have substance abuse issues, and we need to get them help. We're allowing them to just die on the street. It used to be that when somebody came into the justice system and they had a mental health issue, we could say, all right, we don't want to send you to prison, but that's where you're going unless you, for a year, stay in this drug treatment program. And we would see lives change. With Prop 47, which was authored by George Gascon, we lost that ability. Now there's people come in and they get arrested for, you know, dealing drugs or whatever, and it's kind of like, they just, give me my jail time, I want to do drugs, right? But those of us watching someone who's, and everybody has done this, watching someone struggle with drug addiction, know that sometimes there are children involved that get neglected. There are people missing these folks. They die way too often from overdose. And when you love somebody, you just can't sit by and watch them. So we need some changes. We need some options.
So how do you feel about that? Prisoners that have done their time, they paid their debt to society. How do you feel about them getting their rights fully restored, voting and et cetera?
I agree with it. If you've abandoned that life, you've done your time, I'm all in. I've had members of my own family who have done time and they've come out. They're doing well. So, of course, it's redemption is possible and we ought to encourage it.
Ms. Lacey, you hear and read about secret societies within the police force and SWAT teams. What's your take on these? Are they real? Do they exist? Are they having an impact?
Well, they obviously exist. There's enough evidence out there to show that. And we ought to root it out. The police should not be run or shouldn't have gang members within their ranks. That's terrible. It's challenging to get officers to come forward and tell on each other. But I encourage anyone who's in a police force or the sheriff's department, you got it. This is wrong. You have to tell, and you should come forward. We have prosecuted, we currently have a case we're prosecuting where it's not exactly on point, but the officers were falsely identifying people in the community as being gang members. I think I was more mad about that case than a lot of other cases that I've seen, because it's kind of like you label somebody, you ruin their lives, for what? What is the gain for them? But you can see that the feds are doing a great job. The FBI is doing a great job of investigating that. Police officers are going to jail for a lot of that kind of criminal activity. And that's not why I signed up to do this work, in the sense of I don't support that at all. And think that if you are a member of a gang, you're part of the police department, you ought to go to jail.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you about a case that's really been kind of controversial here in this area, and that's the Ed Buck case. Why did it take so long to get some action on that?
You know, when we first got the Ed Buck case, first of all, I don't know Ed Buck. He there's some talk that he had political connections. I had never even heard of him before. But what was challenging, Pat, is probably the same challenge if you remember the John Belushi case when he died of an overdose and they were charging a woman named Kathy, I can't remember her last name. It was difficult for us to find evidence that Buck injected the man who died. So for instance, if he had just furnished drugs to him and then he injected himself and died, under our code, that would not have been a crime. Under the federal government, it was, but under our code, it would. So we had challenges with that. We also had some evidence suppressed, illegally seized and suppressed in Mr. Buck's home that first go around. Second go round, same thing. We couldn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt, we couldn't find evidence to prove that Buck was the injector as opposed to just supplying the drug. And we didn't want to file a lesser charge because we had heard stories. So finally, with the third person who came forward, finally we had someone who could say, yeah, this is what he did to me. And so by that, we were able to use that instance for the others who filed. You know, these cases are so tough, Pat, because you see the victims, you see the survivors, and you want to file things, but you have to have the discipline to know that unless you're able to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt, you can't find them. So I am, you're helping the feds with their case. They've got a good case, and it just wasn't necessary to show that in their case that Buck was the injector.
Jackie, everybody knows about the situation with your husband on the front porch of your house with Black Lives Matter and the gun. That can work itself out in the courts. We're not going to talk about that in that way. And Judge, I would like to know, what was the conversation like inside your house, both before he walked out with the gun and then when he came back in?
That's part of the evidence in my husband's case. And here's what I want people to know who are trying to figure out what happened to us. The same day that the Attorney General filed charges against my husband, Judge Fallis in New Jersey went public with what happened to her son, who answered the door when there was a delivery, guy dressed as delivery, and he shot and killed him, her son, and shot her husband. These are dangerous jobs. Just like she gets threats, I get threats all the time. And you never know who's on the other side of that door. And my husband loves me, I love him, and we would fight to defend our lives any way we could. And that's what I ask people.
People don't realize that. You've gotten threats throughout your entire career being a prosecutor, haven't you?
Yes, it comes along with the job. And my name is on every criminal complaint, every filing. We prosecute gang members, organized crime members, people who are mentally deranged, who wouldn't mind taking out a prosecutor. People don't realize once you take this job, the risk that you face. And I support protesters. I would be out there if I could, but you know, I've got the situation. But what I was going to say is that it is a dangerous job, and we do live in a dangerous world. And it's just easy to second guess it.
The other thing people don't realize, everything they know about the legal system, most people know from TV. This is a really hard job, and every day you're prosecuting real people. Do you take that home with you? I mean, how do you prevent taking it home from you? That's got to be really, really difficult. I don't know if I'd ever sleep.
When I first got a job as a prosecutor, I was trying to escape a boring corporate job. And a friend of mine said, just try this job, maybe you'll like it. And 2 weeks into it, after going to court, getting my butt kicked in trial, dealing with witnesses, judges, jurors, I realized this is what I was born to do. And when you believe that your place and position for a particular purpose, which is to seek justice for those who can't seek justice for yourself, you actually discount any discomfort, any danger to yourself, because you feel like you're part of a bigger, you know, you're part of a bigger story of democracy and justice. And so it does get challenging. I must admit, I work every day, pretty much the job. You're on the phone, you're checking emails, you're checking news reports. But I love serving the public in this way. I love using my legal education because most of the victims of violent crime are women. Most of the victims of violent crime, about 75%, are people of color. And I've lived in communities where I thought, you know, a community where I thought nobody cared, no one cares about my life. But the truth of the matter is prosecutors care. They're right there on the front lines fighting for justice.
Something people don't know about you, your dad was a victim of violent crime, and they've never caught the people who committed it.
Yeah, my dad was mowing his lawn when, and we lived near an area that's called Baldwin Vista, and now it used to be called the Jungle. And the corridor was Coliseum Street. And so a couple of young men drove by, and one of them pulled out a gun and shot my dad. It broke his leg instantly. He landed on the ground and he played dead because he didn't want them to shoot him again. We believe, in terms of talking, at least he had just, there was a white telephone box right outside, and we live on the corner house. And there was graffiti, and my father was very meticulous, so he painted over the graffiti. And that was an affront to a neighboring gang. And that's why they shot. It changed him, changed us, changed our lives. You never want to go through anything like that, ever. And I saw my dad, who was a very strong black man, hire a gardener, because he was afraid to be out in his front. Whenever he took out the trash, he always had a gun. He was fine. That is a terrible way to live. But that's how he lived.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. But we thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Jackie. We know that whoever wins this election, we are certainly hoping is going to be able to enact some new laws and new policies that are going to help make it easier to convict people who commit crimes, regardless of whether they're a regular civilian or a police officer or anyone else. But we thank you so much, and we wish you luck moving forward.
Thank you all very, very much. And keep playing that good music, okay?
Greg Mack joins us now for a conversation with a public servant who isn't running in November, but who is a respected voice in California and across the nation, and who has been doing her part to improve policing and criminal justice. Here's Greg now with L.A. County Supervisor for the 1st District, Hilda Solis.
All right. Thanks, Pat. I appreciate it. I have with me Supervisor Hilda L. Solis. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me, Greg, and everybody, Pat and Deborah, and of course, 94.7, The Wave.
All right. You got it on the right channel. You said that's your station, huh?
Yes, it is.
Absolutely. You know, I'm such a big admirer of yours. So if you don't mind, I'd like to, you know, kind of recap to people all of your, you know, accolades, if you will. Supervisor Solis is a lifelong resident of the beautiful San Gabriel Valley, a graduate of Cal Poly, Pomona, and USC. Go Trojans! Supervisor Solis has served on the Rio Hondo Community College Board and the State Assembly, State Senate, House of Representatives. Prior to becoming supervisor, Ms. Solis served as Secretary of Labor under President Obama, mind you, the very first Latina to ever serve in the presidential cabinet. And today, Supervisor Solis is representing the San Gabriel Valley, Northeast, Southeast, East LA, LA County Supervisor for the 1st District. Are you busy enough?
Oh my God, yes. But it's good. It's what did Congressman John Lewis say? Make good trouble.
Have you been making good trouble?
Make good trouble. That's absolutely true.
One of the things that I've noticed that you've been doing, and I'm sitting over here like clapping for you, jumping up and down, is the jail reform and what you're doing there. And I'd like for you to tell everybody more about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've had for the last several years now, a lot of work being done on, do we really need to house people in jails that are afflicted with mental health, substance abuse, trauma? And is that the best way to really house people if they have all of those illnesses? And that isn't, you know, the jails weren't set up to do that, but it's known here in LA County as the largest mental health institution, and it is not equipped to really do that, and nor do we really have adequate staffing or room. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is to say, wait a minute, why do we need Men's Central Jail? We're not paying for anything there now, and it is one of the most decrepit, 1930s type of jail that if people were to see what goes on inside, you would be horrified. And I really do want to say that it isn't healthy for the inmates, but also for the people that work there, you know, the uh-huh. employees of the county that work there. So it has to be taken off the table. And all we're saying is, in the last couple of months since COVID-19, we've seen a drop in the number of inmates and people that were there. 5,000 people have been released. So it begs a question. Do we really need to continue to build more jails when we can now release people? And about 40% of the current population there is suffering from mental health. So that tells me and others that we ought to be looking at a different paradigm. We got to be rethinking how we treat people and do it in the community, or restructure those other 6 jails that we have and make them more, how could I say, care first, jail last. So make them so people get well, and that we have the communities involved in helping us provide those supportive wraparound services that are so necessary.
I would think that with what you're talking about there, and on top of a global pandemic, the murder of George Floyd has sparked a global anti-racism protest. What are some of your thoughts on what's happening now? Because I know that you are also involved in, you know, not just, you know, the prisoner situation, but, you know, just criminal justice overall. What are your thoughts as far as where this is going?
Well, I think there's a lot that, given all the movement around this unfortunate death, right, that occurred, mm-hmm. that it has really woke up, so to speak, all of mm-hmm. us. And wait a minute, there's some racial inequities that exist that have been there for, you know, for centuries, maybe for, you know, and that's what we're seeing. And now we've kind of lifted the veil and we're seeing what it really is and how unfair it is to people of color, African Americans, absolutely, Latinos, and other people that have also been mischaracterized. And now we're starting to see it. And part of it is the leaders, elected officials, are taking this on and saying, you know what, we're listening to our residents, to our community, and we're empowering their voices. So this isn't just coming from Hilda Solis. It's coming from a movement of grassroots organizations that have been at it for the last, I want to say, maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe 10 years, because I know there are groups that have been doing a lot of good work, and a lot of them represent our families. So for me, it's about really taking that closely, looking at it, and then figuring out how do we then begin to reimagine what LA County looks like for all of us as we move forward. The pandemic, COVID-19, is forcing us to look at those inequities, and we've got to move now that we have an opportunity. We really do.
And you, as a Latina, me as an African American, what changes do you think needs to take place to combat systemic racism?
Well, I think it begins with our leaders. It begins with people in authority, like the sheriff, for example, and his folks that work in that department. It requires all of us to think about how we can treat people in a different manner, and highlighting the need for more respect, dignity, and humility. I believe those are really key elements in anything that you do. If you're going to transform a system, you really have to be here and hear those voices and have them seated at the table. And our policy should be reflective of that. And so one of the things that we've been working on is the alternatives to incarceration, which was a big, robust plan that the county helped envision. And there were over hundreds of recommendations on how we could treat people instead of in the jail or in probation camps or in juvenile hall, outside in the community. And right now we know that we can put people into safe housing, get them the treatment they need, and then they won't end up going back to the jail or back to probation or back to the probation camp. And it's successful, but we have to put our energy and we have to put some funding there. I mean, it isn't enough that what we've been doing in the past maybe 5 years is enough. It's not. And so we have also going to be before us a potential of voting on actually tax. The voters will say, hey, guess what? I want 10% of the county budget assigned for mental health, assigned for affordable housing for people that are coming out of the justice system, and making sure that there's job training and that there's health care for them and that they have opportunity so that they can go back into our communities and society and reunite with their families and where their roots are. I mean, why should we continue to house people unnecessarily in jails that confine people in cage-like settings that create more trauma?
What do you want to tell everyone to maybe give them some kind of comfort in knowing that you guys, as the supervisors, are making changes in order to improve what's going on with not only just the police but the community in whole? You have that opportunity right now to tell them. Just tell them.
Well, I would just say that we are working hard to right now face this pandemic, COVID-19. Too many of our African American and Latino and people of color are out of work. Unemployment is skyrocketing higher than what it was when I worked for Obama and Biden. And we have to bring it down. We have to make sure that we combat that food insecurity. So we need to do more of these food banks, giving food out to families that don't have jobs and kids. They need help. We need to make sure that we're fighting for access for better education, helping to bridge that digital divide that exists, because a lot of our kids don't even have internet at home. They can't afford it. And so we've got to ask our businesses to jump in and help us. And we've got to make sure that people that are working right now, both African-American and Latinos, have the highest rate of COVID and deaths. Okay? And we've got to fix this. We've got to make sure that we take care of our workers every single day that they go out, that they have the PPE, protective equipment, and that their employers are also taking care of them. And every employee has a right to report anonymously if they see that they're not being treated fairly in the workplace because of COVID. I mean, those are our basic rights, and the county has to stand up and protect individuals. So those are the things that I would say, and that we've got to get the federal government. By golly, we got to change that. We've got to get relief. The CARES Act has to be extended. We need to have that unemployment insurance, and we need funding for the counties and the cities, because how are we going to provide health care? How are we going to provide any of these meals, nutritional meals for seniors that are homebound? How are we going to take care of our kids, our babies, if we don't have those essential services? It doesn't come from the state of California. They don't have the money. It has to come from the federal government. So call your U.S. senators, call that White House, and don't stop and don't give up and make good trouble.
There you go. And I knew you were going to throw in there, so I'll just throw it in there for you. Get out and vote. Make sure you get out and vote. That's how you make change.
November 3rd. And you can vote by mail. You don't even have to leave the comfort of your kitchen, right? Mm-hmm. Your table. You can just do it right there. And don't forget the census. The census is so important because it fuels the funding that we have to have all these social service programs. It pays for hospitals, clinics, or K-12, Head Start, all of these good things that we rely on, including the CalFresh program, all of these things that are essential to our families here in LA County.
Supervisor Hilda L. Solis, thank you so much for being on Justice Now. And I know that since you're such a big fan of Pat Prescott, she's waiting for us now. So maybe you want to introduce her.
Ooh. Oh, my God, Pat Prescott, she is the queen of jazz. So we love her, and a big admirers of all of you, and Deborah Howell too. So, God bless you all in 94.7 The Wave.
Thank you so much, Supervisor Solis. Well, we have heard a lot tonight. And I tell you, my biggest takeaway, Frankie, really is that we need to be educated about voting. Yeah, yes. I mean, this is so important to sit down and listen to what people have to say and to ask them some questions and to do some research on it. What do they stand for? We've got to not only ask them questions, but do like we did in this forum. Really let them talk. I mean, when have you heard people be able to talk?
I don't think I've ever heard in all of the interviews I've seen or heard Jackie Lacey where she was so emotional. Mm-hmm. She really was passionate. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a side of her that was really important, not only for us to see today, but I think if she gets through the election and if she wins beyond the election, Los Angeles needs to see.
Yeah. She talked about her father being shot.
Yeah.
That was really emotional for her.
Yeah, that was really something.
Yeah.
But I was impressed also with Gascon, who has a really beautiful story, too, as a Cuban immigrant, you know, back in the day and coming here to America, not being able to speak English very well. I think that we have good candidates, but it is up to us to really examine them and figure out who we're going to vote for. The election is coming up.
But, you know, Gascon came back from San Francisco, and he mentioned it in the interview, to be with his mom. His mom's 93. Mm-hmm. I believe she's in an assisted living facility. Mm-hmm. And he comes back, and then COVID hits. Mm-hmm. So now being with mom means on the phone. Mm-hmm. Being with mom means separated by glass. Mm-hmm. But he decided to come home to be close to family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need a little bit more family now, too.
Yeah. These candidates are people, and we need to look at them as that and really see the totality of who they are. We hope that you'll be joining us on the next episode of Justice Now. We want to quickly remind you about the 2020 census. The feds have moved up the deadline. You had until the end of October. Now you only have until the end of September. This means money for you, for your community. So please take a moment to fill out the 2020 census. And thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Justice Now.
94.7 The Wave.
Justice Now.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.